This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 19th of August 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 163, with me, Andrew Tuck, and Steve Bloomfield. On today's show, we'll be turning the tables and asking questions to British journalist, author, and TV newsman Gavin Esler.
We'll also be talking about the delights of rural music making with American musician Matthew Deer.
And we'll be chatting through the post-Olympic lull with musician, writer, and filmmaker Bob Stanley, better known as one third of the pop band Saint Etienne.
All that, plus some great music as ever, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Now, we're not going to linger on this, and it is a week since it finished, but there is still a bit of a lull, isn't there, about the Olympics in London?
There is, although the closing ceremony was so bad that, in a sense, I think that helped because it made us think, OK, let's just forget about it now.
And also, I think that we do forget there are going to be the Paralympic Games, and actually bits of London, they haven't kind of deconstructed the everything that was put up for the actual Olympic Games. So where I live, there's a square that was kind of barricaded off because of where all the journalists are based. And I presume they're all expected back again because they've left it kind of barricaded off with all the nice little Olympic bus stands for the journalists to go out.
They've got little bus stands, haven't
they're
they?
They're
pink. Their own ones.
They're pink.
Oh, they're
nice. A bit camp, but they're very nice.
I'm quite looking forward to the Paralympics, particularly because I have tickets for it, which I didn't have for the Olympics. So I'm going to get to see the stadium and the aquatic centre and the whole park. But most importantly, I think I'm not the only one who's done that, obviously, because otherwise it would just be me on my own in a stadium. But there's lots of people who didn't get tickets have now got them for the Paralympics, and they're going to be sold out.
And I did do one other kind of Olympic-connected thing, because I've had a couple of days off. And
yeah, we've noticed.
Well, I normally have a couple of days off, but I'm just in the office. I've actually had a couple of days off and not been in the office. I've been high-speed doing culture catch-up.
Oh, yeah?
Damien Hirst. Exactly. Bad. I like the black sheep. That's the only one. I like the black sheep in formaldehyde, and I like the shark in the black tank at the end. But kind of as decoration, nothing else.
Yeah, it didn't grab me, the Hearst. What else did you see? Did you get to see the Bauhaus at the Barbican?
No, but I went to see Another London, which I would recommend, which is at Tate Britain, which is an amazing series of photographs taken between 1930 and 1970, roughly five. And they're only photographs taken by people who are not British and not Londoners. So there, it starts with like sort of Cartier-Bresson, but it takes in all these amazing, often kind of Jewish emigres who were coming from Nazi Germany, and they were coming via London on their way to New York. And it's their depictions of what they see London looking at, and it's just riveting. It's one of the nicest collections of photographs I've seen, and they were all donated by two collectors who had a dealership in photography, and they've donated thousands of photographs to Tate Britain. But it's after seeing Damien Hirst, I kind of went to see that, and it was such a relief to see something that was so modest but so revealing, and something before that, you know, I know it's all about the showmanship and thing, but it does get a bit tiresome.
Well, indeed, yeah. Oh, well, I'll have to go and see
anyway,
that. Anyway, that sounds very good.
That's,
I'm glad you've been sort of making use of your time off.
Bobby Bound, we don't need you. We have our own culture show. this is The Culture with Steve Bloomfield and Andrew Tuck. No, it's not really. Now, this is the bit of the week where we also bring in somebody to tell us, like a Mystic Meg character, what's going to be lying ahead in the news over the coming week. And today, it's the turn of Tom Mystic Edwards. Hello, Tom Edwards.
Hello.
We should say you are our news editor. You were looking quite mystic then.
I think it was more confused.
No, I was trying to envision the news of the future.
The news of the future. You don't have to look very far ahead. We just want to know what's going to happen in the following week, don't we, Steve?
We do.
We thought we'd start on Monday. Why not?
Why not?
Back to business. And that's
so
where we start.
Tomorrow?
Yeah, right. It's the final day for Greece to repay a €3 billion loan from the European Central Bank. And it's likely they're probably going to need more money from the troika of the EC, ECB and IMF.
They'll need more money to pay back the loan to
one of the people who lent them the money before.
Right.
So big problems for them, really. It could take them one step closer tomorrow to insolvency and ultimately possibly having to fracture and leave the euro. So, another day.
That's cheery. That made everyone very happy.
Another day, another dollar. But I thought,
look at your face is miserable as well. You can't even read that story with a bit of gusto.
Well, that's why I thought we should look to something a bit more high-minded.
Thank you.
And dreamy.
That was quite high-minded. It just wasn't very dreamy.
So the day after tomorrow, on Tuesday, NASA is going to test drive its Mars rover. Now, remember, they successfully deposited it on the surface of the red planet.
I'm quite looking forward to this.
And now they're going to set it about doing some, you know, missions.
Oh, I didn't realise it's not moved yet.
I think, well, it might have moved very slightly. I think they maybe have testing bits of the equipment. But they're actually going to test drive it, get it to start motoring around, seeing what it can find up there. Have you that's quite exciting, generally.
Yeah, it's amazingly exciting.
Have you seen the very nice photo that's been going around on social media sites of Mars observed from the Milky Way? And it's someone who've got they've got a Milky Way bar, a chocolate bar at the front, and there's the Mars bar in the background. It's very good. Mm. Or maybe it's the other way around. But anyway, it involves those two chocolate bars. That's about my level of science, actually. So anyway,
but there'll be we're going to have better science experts, I think, okay, on next week all about this.
It weighs a lot, doesn't it? I believe it's like a tank. It's not like those little ones they used to send up were like midget ones.
Well, this is it, but it's called the Mars Rover. It sounds so sweet, almost like it's a kind of canine quality to it. But
it's the Curiosity Rover.
It's a hefty piece of kit, the Curiosity Rover.
I'm pleased that NASA did it. I think it's amazing, but I still think it's a shame that the British one, all those years ago, didn't work. Beagle 2, with Colin Pilkington, with his amazing sideburns and his sort of West Country accent.
It's funny they're all named after dogs. Rover? Yeah. Come here, Rover. Well, actually, maybe Rover's only a British dog's name.
Mm. And Beagle isn't necessarily a dog's name, but
it's a type of dog.
Yeah. I see what you're trying to say there, though.
Canine.
Rover is international. I remember Jimi Hendrix said, "Move over, Rover. Let Jimmy take over."
Was he talking about a dog, though?
Yeah, he literally was.
Okay. Really?
Yeah. Let me stand next to the fire. That's that song. Okay. He wanted to stand next to the fire, but Rover was in the way.
You sure he was singing about the song?
I guarantee you that's true.
You're a bit naive, Tom Edwards. Anyway, next.
Now move on.
Well, I thought you mentioned about Olympic hangover. I know Andrew particularly been very sad to lose all the athletics you've been following so closely.
And the athletes as
sports
well.
Correspondent.
But fear not. Not only the Paralympics. This week, on Thursday, Usain Bolt is in action once again at the Diamond League meeting in Lausanne in Switzerland. So you can watch the great man pushing the barriers of human achievement once again.
I think he's probably not going to be that good on Thursday. I think they're all going to be a little bit, we've had the Olympics, you know.
What is the Diamond League, by the way?
Diamond League is the elite series of races for the world's finest athletes that takes place throughout Europe.
It's quite hilly, Lausanne. I hope they find a flat bit for him to do it on.
Well, no, but you see, this actually helps. Quite high altitude. Helps for better performances. It's a fast track, traditionally.
Yeah, he's not going to break a world record, so is he?
He may not.
And do you have a fourth item for us?
Got one last little one.
Okay.
Another one to watch later this week. Stephen Goff goes on trial in Kirkcaldy in Scotland. He's a rambler.
Oh, is he? Oh, I know what he is.
Well, he doesn't put his clothes on, does he?
Yeah. That's right. Now, he's already appeared in court once. He attended, nude, refused to dress, saying, "Nudity is an appropriate outfit." So he's going to be back in court on Thursday. Now, that's one to keep a fairly close eye on, but not that close, perhaps.
No, not too close. And I don't want him coming in here to be interviewed. We'd have to put a flannel down before he sat down, I think. I don't want him sitting on our Eames chairs. On our fabric Eames chairs with his...
That's true. Oh, that could...
I remember when he first did his naked rambling, which was, what, 7, 8 years ago? And it was when I was working at The Independent, and there was a bit of a discussion about who on the news desk was going to go rambling with him. And I remember a man called Jonathan Brown drew the short straw and had his picture taken in the paper.
With no clothes on?
With no clothes on, because the naked rambler said, "You can ramble with me, but you have to also be naked like me." So there was an interesting picture of the naked rambler and Jonathan Brown.
You don't want to
from behind.
You don't want to come across a gorse bush when you're naked rambling, do you? Or a stinging nettle.
Or a nettle, yes, exactly. Or a yappy rover or beagle.
Okay. And one last thing. If you go and see that photographic exhibition, they've got a very good photo of a streaker from the 70s. Streaking should come back, shouldn't it? I miss streaking.
There was no streaking at the Olympics, was there?
No.
Yeah.
That's how difficult it was to get tickets.
The streaker's tried, but it didn't happen. Is it the streaker, the famous streaker at Twickenham?
No, it's not. It's a curious picture. There is a policeman standing there, but there's a huge crowd gathered around a naked man who's got his arms very kind of confidently on his hips, thrusting forward. You can see all, but it's just the reaction of the crowd. They're all kind of like really pleased what he's doing. That's the best part of the picture. Anyway,
there we are.
Enough nudity. You didn't see it here. on the wonderful Monocle Weekly. Thank you, Tom, very much for that. And you are indeed listening to the Monocle Weekly. Now, our first guest is one of those faces of BBC News, an award-winning television and radio broadcaster and author.
Over the past two decades, Gavin Eslett has gone toe-to-toe with world leaders and personalities, from Chirac to Clinton, both of them, Daniel Ortega to Dolly Parton. His new book, Lessons from the Top, aims to distill some of those experiences into useful advice on leadership. I sat down with him a little earlier to talk about leaders from the White House to Downing Street and beyond.
Actually, the kicking off point is that we're all storytellers in one way or another. We might not think of that, but it's true. When you apply for a job, you tell a story about yourself in your resume or CV. You tell a story when you want to be promoted. If you're a business and you go into a bank and you want to expand, you tell a story and they listen to the story about who you are, who we are as a kind of common enterprise, and where your leadership will take you. And it struck me that those are the sort of stories that leaders just tell better than everybody else. So we can learn as individuals and as businesses and so on from studying some of these leaders, most of whom I've met. And also, I was hoping to encourage us to be a little bit more sceptical of the kind of stories that leaders tell, which are quite often for their benefit rather than for ours.
Now, you mentioned, you know, you're talking about a lot of leaders that you've met yourself, and you're wanting people to be a little bit more sceptical. Have you always yourself been sceptical enough, or, you know, early on in your career, did you find yourself sort of dazzled by amazing stories that when you look back now think, oh, hang on, they were just spinning me a yarn?
Well, there's some stories in the book which at the time I got wrong, or we all got wrong. It's a great one about Bill Clinton, true story. Just after he was elected, he had a haircut on Air Force One on the tarmac in Los Angeles. And it led the news in America for 3 days. It was known as Hair Force One because the guy who cut his hair was a barber who charged $200 an hour, or $200 a haircut, in Beverly Hills. And Bill Clinton apologized, or the White House apologized, for keeping people delayed at Los Angeles Airport. Ages later, we discovered that actually nobody was inconvenienced by this. There were no delays to any planes. But the Clinton team quite rightly recognized that when the president of the United States in 1993 is having a haircut that costs $200, maybe most of us don't know how much an aircraft carrier should cost, but we all know that's a lot to pay to have your haircut. And so they apologized for something which they hadn't done, but gave the impression that they were contrite about something which they had done, which was bad for them. And Clinton was one of the great storytellers, like Blair, Thatcher, Reagan, and others that feature in the book. But that's an interesting example of something which the media, me included, didn't get right, because we didn't know the real story until it finally came out.
Although, interestingly, Clinton could perhaps get away with that because he was such a great storyteller, whereas a decade or so later, John Edwards famously had a $400 haircut and he wasn't such a great storyteller.
Well, that's exactly part of it. That's exactly part of it. That you, I have one chapter about how to handle a scandal, and how Clinton survived the Lewinsky scandal, and how Ronald Reagan survived the Iran-Contra scandal in the 1980s. You know, you've got the left and right of American politics, but they were the best communicators of my lifetime in the United States that I can think of. And they were very, very good at telling a story. Now, whether the stories are true or false is an interesting question. And I'm not interested in the policies of the various individuals, because when somebody comes up to you and says, oh, you've met Bill Clinton or you've met Margaret Thatcher, what are they like? They're not asking you how they would cut taxes or raise taxes or anything like that. They're actually asking you, what are they like as a human being? And that's something that when we see these leaders on television, we all think we're experts on, even if we don't know what the right thing to do for the economy might be. And that's why telling stories about yourself for leaders is so important.
Now, obviously, you've been working in television for decades, and it's the power of pictures is fairly recent phenomenon. In this country, in the UK, it was the 1979 election where with Margaret Thatcher, who was sort of the first politician who really got the importance of pictures. In the US, as you talk about in your book, in the 84 election, Ronald Reagan and his team really understood the importance of pictures. Talk a little bit about Reagan in particular and that election, sort of how he really got and his team really got why the picture was far more important than the words.
Well, this was an extraordinary development for modern democracies. Now it's been copied all around the world. In the 84 election, Reagan's team recognised that his policies were very divisive, but his personality charmed people, even those who didn't like his policies, including in Congress. I talked to a number of very senior Democrats who, when they would rail against his policies, would say to me at the end, but I really like the guy. And part of that was he looked good. He was an actor, a good-looking guy for his age. And when he was discussing environmental policies, and his record on the environment was, let's say, at least controversial.
Yeah.
Some people thought that he had a shocking record on the environment. But he would very often be seen on a horse in the American West or with Grand Canyon or some other wonderful backdrop behind him. So as a casual viewer of television, and we're all casual viewers of television. It's not, you know, very few people sit there and really, really pay attention. You get the idea that there is this guy in an open neck shirt in the American West, which always looks brilliant, and he's talking about the environment. And that's it. That's the message. And the Reagan team understood that perfectly, just as Mrs. Thatcher's team understood that to show Mrs. Thatcher washing the dishes in Downing Street was such a breakthrough for British politics. And when she said, I'm a grocer's daughter from Grantham, there's storytelling in four or five words. You know, she's a grocer's daughter, she's not posh, she's a daughter, not a son, so she's not like male leaders. And she's from Grantham, she's not really one of the upper classes, was what that message said. And washing up in Downing Street, the picture was part of it.
Now, what's striking now compared to, say, you know, a generation ago about political leaders is that they all, pretty much all of them, have their own autobiographies, or they have biographies that they've approved of, that have been written about them. And you look at those stories that they tell about themselves or others tell about themselves, and they're all remarkably similar. They all seem to have a, you know, I had a hard upbringing, there was a struggle, but I overcame that through the force of my own will. I mean, do we only have one type of leader who has that story, or has everyone tried to force their own life story into that template?
I think it's the latter. That I have a bit of fun with the reader where I have quotes from five different biographies or autobiographies of American leaders, and they all sound like the same bloke, except one's a black guy, one's a white woman, and the other three come from completely different parts of the United States. So one of the funny bits is George W. Bush, who talks about this. It was a kind of ordinary upbringing in Midland, Texas. His father was vice president and then president of the United States. His grandfather was a senator. So you read this stuff and it all reads very well. And then you have to say at some point, hold on a minute, this is you telling a story about you. And it's a little bit of, I was Abraham Lincoln in a log cabin. Is it really true?
Does that then surely not reflect poorly on journalists, that these leaders are able to get away with telling those stories without someone saying, hang on, you are the son of a president, don't give us this, oh, woe is me, my life was terrible type story?
I think it does. I think there's a lot of things that reflect quite badly on journalism that I talk about in the book. I mean, basically, I do think that all leaders tell these three stories. Who am I as a person? Who are we as a political party, as the Conservatives or the Democrats or New Democrats? In Clinton's case, New was part of his storytelling. And then where will my leadership take us? What is our common purpose? And I think journalists are very good at the third part of that. Where's my leadership taking us? We're quite good at unpicking policies and saying, but you said this before, and will it really create jobs by raising taxes or lowering taxes? We're good at that. But when it comes to, I was poor, but I was honest, and my family were, you know, had no money, but we all pulled together, we don't look back at the biographies so much. A good example, I think, actually, is Mrs. Thatcher, who was blessed by the Soviet Union and being called the Iron Lady. And it became a huge part of her image that she was not for turning, the lady's not for turning. Behind the scenes, she certainly listened to advice. She changed her mind sometimes, famously about the poll tax publicly. But there were a number of other things which she thought about. That's what you'd expect in a good leader. But she had an image of this is the sort of person she is personally. And it did fit into kind of a bossy personality that she could have. But it was only part of the story. And I think it takes a bit of a while for journalists to catch up with that.
Now, you don't just talk about leaders in a political sense. You talk about, you know, cultural leaders and figures and business leaders as well. Is it a little bit of a stretch to say, you know, that someone like Lady Gaga is telling a similar story to Ronald Reagan?
No, I don't think it's a stretch at all, actually. I mean, Lady Gaga features in the book for a couple of reasons, but one is she was the subject of a study, an academic study by some academics who said, she tells those stories. Who am I, Lady Gaga? I'm a monster. Who are we, my fans? You're my little monsters. And where is my leadership going to take us? We're going to make a better world. It's okay if you don't fit in. It's, you know, it's great if you're gay, your sexual orientation is fantastic, whatever it is. You know, those are the three leadership stories. And it's not surprising that on Twitter and on the internet, she is followed. And what do you follow? You follow a leader.
I want to ask you about yourself. Have you done this with yourself and asked yourself, you know, who am I and what's the story I'm trying to tell? You know, where are we going? Where are the Eslerites following me to? I mean, how have you sort of tried to craft a story about yourself?
Well, working backwards, unfortunately, there are no Eslerites. So, I mean, my own story is I was born in Glasgow for the first 3 years of my life. I lived in a council house with my mum and dad, my granny and two aunties. So I actually do fit in. Genuinely do fit into the we were
and
poor,
one of your
but
parents
we were
wasn't actually prime minister
but nobody was actually prime minister, and they got on, and it was an aspirational story, and I you know, I'm inspired by the aspirational story of my parents. So and the other bit which I do think about is when I was 3 weeks old, so I'm too young to remember it, I nearly died because I was very sick. And so I do think about that. I do think about what it must be like to die before you've lived, which makes me quite sentimental about child poverty when I see pictures of areas where there are children starving, as there are unfortunately in too many places. I get quite emotional about it, even though I don't actually remember it. So it was a story that was retold to me, and is a true story. So that's not something I would put on a CV, but is absolutely the core of who I am, actually. The book has been a bit of a revelation to me in thinking about that and thinking about what it is that is important to me as a person.
But is that more important for you yourself, the story that you are telling yourself about who you are and where you're from, and without going too over the top, what your purpose in life is, rather than, say, the story that you want to necessarily tell other people about, you know, why they should like you or why they should promote you or, you know, you know, why you should get a different job at the BBC or whatever it is that you want to do next.
You should read my CV. It's fantastic. Absolutely amazing. I mean, obviously, I'd like people to think I'm a great writer and this is a fantastic book which will change the world. I hope it actually does change the way people tell stories. If I were interested in running for political office, I would tell that story. What I wouldn't do, absolutely would not do, is when I've listened to some politicians in the book and really the trigger that made me write this. The stories go back some years, of course, right back as far as Thatcher and Reagan, but also include Blair and David Cameron and people up to date. But the trigger of writing it was the 2010 election campaign. When I heard some of the stories that politicians were telling about their personal lives and some of the questions that interviewers thought were appropriate to ask during the worst political crisis of our lifetimes, people were being asked, are you good in bed? I have no interest whether any politician is good in bed, but obviously something has changed, and I think very much for the worse, in the media. And it's a product, I also go into that, a product of the last 30 years and this confusion between celebrity culture and people in the public eye, like politicians, from whom we expect a lot better.
And that was Gavin Esler talking about his new book, Lessons from the Top. We're going to play a little bit of music in a moment. You're listening to Monocle Weekly.
The perfect accompaniment to summer is a well-mixed cocktail. So as the season hits its stride, we handpicked a trio of bartenders from around the world to prepare for us their cocktail du jour. From Tokyo to São Paulo via Beirut, we filmed the maestros at work. Headlining the Yoshida Martini, the Lychee Caipirinha, and the Aromatic Smash. Pull up a bar stool for a front row seat. Monocle Films on monocle.com.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Steve Bloomfield. Now, the next bit of the script, Steve, it's got one of those things at the beginning of it, which you don't like.
I don't know. No.
So we get cross because we don't like that, because it's very hard to introduce a song without introducing it in exactly the same way every time. Mm. And one of the things we don't like is when you say, time for some music now. So,
yeah.
So we won't say that.
Shall we instead talk about the banana bread? Or
that
banana cake.
That isn't the name of the band.
No.
Although it's quite a good name for a band, the Banana Bread.
It is actually, isn't it? Yes.
I'd buy them.
Would you? Yeah.
Yes. We've been given banana bread during banana that last cake. Little interlude. Tom Edwards, he didn't bake it himself, but he dashed to the kitchen because he heard there was some banana bread available. Mm. And he's delivered it to us.
It looks amazing. I really want to eat it now. But let's play some music instead.
Yes. That's almost right. We're going to have to do it. Well, now we're so scared of all the cliches. This is music. How about that? This is music.
That's how you should.
These are musicians. There's two of them, apparently. Both young, it says here. Both from Seattle. And they do their own thing with electropop. This is Beat Connection with The Palace Garden, 4 a.m.
That was music by musicians.
That's alternative. No one's said that before. That's good.
No, that was the Palace Garden, 4 a.m. by Beat Connection. I rather liked them. They were good, weren't they?
I like that very much indeed. And it's quite nice being in the Palace Garden as well.
Yeah, and at 4 a.m.
Yes.
It kind of did give that impression that you were in the Palace Garden at 4 a.m. We could belabor this point somewhat.
Because we're heading somewhere a bit different next, I think.
Yes, we'll be talking Wastelands. Slightly different, isn't that? With Bob Stanley of the wonderful St. Etienne.
This time last week, London was preparing to say farewell to what was almost unilaterally agreed to be a very successful Olympics.
But as the music and applause dies away, there's a growing choir of voices lamenting what might have actually been lost to the greatest show on earth. A couple of weeks ago, we discussed artistic dissent against the Olympic movement, and this week we spare a thought for that once obscure corner of East London, the Lee Valley, once utterly derelict, now rebuilt as the Olympic Park.
Our next guest is Bob Stanley, one third of one of our favourite pop bands, St. Etienne, who in 2005 were commissioned to direct a creative documentary with a live soundtrack called What Did You Do Today, Mervyn Day? An elegy looking at the last days of the Lee Valley. The film is now being re-released and Bob is going to join us on the line in a moment. But first of all, we're going to hear a clip from the film.
Well, to me, the Lee Valley begins here at Hackney Wick, and I think it ends at Walthamstow somewhere.
Everything's basically under Lee Valley. Lee Valley bike riding, Lee Valley ice skating, Lee Valley swimming.
We just call it the Wick, or up the Wick, the Wick. Lee Valley, if someone said to me Lee Valley, I would think of the ice skating ring and places like that. But round here, we just call it the Wick, yeah.
People may not know the name, but this is where the Vikings were repelled and the first paper mills were built. It's the birthplace of the technological revolution.
Yeah, it's like you're expected to be in different parts and things like that, but to come just up the road from where you live in Hackney Wick, that's something to be proud of.
Well, that was a clip from the film What Did You Do Today, Mervyn Day? And Bob is on the line now. He's at a music festival just outside Vienna. Bob, thanks so much for coming on. First of all, for our listeners around the world, who is Mervyn Day?
Well, Mervyn Day in the film is a paper boy. We negotiate this area of the Lower Lee Valley by following all this paper round, because it's a very complicated area covered in tiny little backwaters and rivers and canals. But he's named after the footballer. He was a goalkeeper for West Ham and Charlton in the 70s. Got a great name, just sort of stuck in our minds, and we thought that's what we'd name the character, because obviously West Ham's the nearest football club to the Lee Valley. So,
and obviously an awful lot has changed in the 7 years since you made this film. The Olympic Park has risen up since then. I mean, have you been down to Olympic Park since it's all been done, and what do you make of it?
I think most of it looks amazing, to be honest. I mean, I managed to go and see some swimming, so I got inside the aquatic centre, and it's really beautiful. And the velodrome is really beautiful as well. I mean, the main stadium is okay. The way the whole area has been landscaped, I think it's going to look really, really nice once the Olympics are over as well. It's like I said, there's loads of waterways there, and they were just clogged up and polluted and a mess 7 years ago, and now it's going to look great. I mean, I worry about who's actually going to be still living there to appreciate it from the people who were there 7 years ago, but can't be denied the park is pretty special.
And in terms of you know, whether you think it's a good thing or not, I mean, lots of people have, you know, said, you know, before the park was built, said, you know, this is going to ruin the Lee Valley, that actually, as you say, you know, lots of people who had used it beforehand won't be able to use it again. Have your views changed at all now that you've seen it?
I was fairly pro beforehand, just because, I mean, spending a few weeks down there, you realise, you know, it's a huge area, it was really polluted, it stank. The industry that was around there was basically the very far end of, like, you know, what you do with animals. So it was like glue and God knows what else. It was pretty grisly. I think most people who were sort of sticking up for the area as it was, or missed it, now it's gone, were people who would go cycling around there. And it was remarkable. It was this huge, desolate area with nobody there. So I know Ian Sinclair's been banging the drum for it, and a lot of people who used it to cycle around or just to walk around at the time will miss it. But I really cannot see how anybody could say it was better before than it is now. The thing I've changed my mind on just in the last few weeks, not because of the Olympics itself, but as like a knock-on effect, all the areas around there, a lot of the land was bought by the LDA, which doesn't exist anymore, and that land's now passed on to the mayor's office, so Boris Johnson can just do whatever he wants with it. And I know IKEA have bought a huge chunk of it. It was meant to be all social housing. So, I mean, it's like, that's the downside. But that way, to like stand on the soapbox, it's quite depressing.
You don't sound very... What's nice is this isn't a film about nostalgia in the sense that you don't want anything to be changed. But do you think that, you know, was part of it when you began to make the film, were you interested in how, you know, Britain as a nation does, or, you know, look after its past or its history, and how it continues to tell the stories of people, you know, that live in this country?
I suppose I don't think of myself as nostalgic. I just think of myself as being interested in social history. But if you find something that survived for decades, just like an old cafe, which I love old cafes, but there's a story there, and the fact they could just get ripped out and turned into a kebab shop overnight and it's all gone, I find very sad. So I think something we've tried to do with all our films, really, is just to like record something when it's on the verge of disappearing. It's just, that's what we've come to do. I think, you're always sort of battling against, especially in London, battling against the constant change when you're trying to film that kind of thing, because things will just disappear without at a moment's notice. This is the nature of the city, which is why we love it and why we all live here. But it's not nostalgia, but it's like trying to capture a moment in time, I suppose, before it's too late.
And you certainly have done that. Bob Stanley, thank you very much indeed for joining us from just outside Vienna. That was Bob Stanley of St Etienne. The film is What Have You Done Today, Mervyn Day. It's released on DVD by Heavenly Films. It's out now. Get it. And finally today, we talk music. Matthew Deer is an American producer working under a number of aliases in the place where avant-garde pop meets futuristic techno. That's Detroit, then. a collaborator with the ever-interesting New York label Ghostly since he started recording, and now one of the biggest and most prolific electro artists in the world, Matthew Dear popped by the showbiz desk here last week to tell Robert Bound about touring his new record Beams and why he's moved from Brooklyn to upstate New York's woody shades.
Matthew, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Are you fresh from your new place in upstate New York?
Yeah, kind of.
Smelling of pine needles, perhaps? Pastures?
Pine sap and hammocks.
I knew there was something. That's why I turned down the air conditioning.
Oh, thanks. You're matching the environment. The climate is perfect.
And how come the move? You were in Michigan, weren't you?
Oh, no, I was in Brooklyn for a while.
You were in Brooklyn?
Yeah, yeah.
I can't keep up.
I know, I moved too much. It was Texas, then Michigan, then New York, and now upstate New York.
And now upstate New York. Yeah. What's going on up there? Why is it so great to... Is it a place to record, or is it a place to think before you kind of jam down back downtown?
It's quiet. So it's a bit of both, yeah. It gives me some thinking time and some creative space as well, yeah.
And the new record, Beams, is that where you recorded it, or is that where it was conceived?
No, I finished that in Brooklyn. So I was working on that for the last, I'd say, 6 months, and finishing touches were done almost in May. So it's been sitting around for a while. And now I'm just kind of, reveling in the move and thinking about the next album.
I guess you must be, because you're very prolific. You do so much stuff. I guess, is it a bit frustrating to have something that, as you say, has been sort of hanging around for a while and you can't wait to tell people about it, can't wait for the music to get out there?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's always an urge to get new music out and share as much as I can. So just got to keep up with it.
Share as much as you can.
Yeah.
Is that what the record's going to sound like, a share record?
No, maybe the next one.
Damn. I know. All that kind of, all the space and the sparrows and the birds and the grass of upstate New York will definitely produce a share sound-alike record, won't it? I mean, that's presumably what everyone's, that's what everyone's waiting for.
That's always the goal, I think.
And you're moving around. Is that because you kind of have a natural idea of exploration, or does that inform the music? I mean, the stuff you made in Michigan and Detroit and stuff, that was, is it was that more electronic because it was part of that scene than the rest of the stuff that you've done?
Definitely, environment affects the way that I work. In Detroit, you know, there's a sense of you being kind of an only soul. The city's kind of desolate and very sparse. So in Detroit, you have this giant playground. And you get to kind of go back to your studio and use that energy and that kind of vastness and apply it to your music. And then, of course, the electronic scene there, techno and everything. So you have these embodied moments, you know, that kind of grow from there. New York, quite the opposite. You know, you're in this city that's just bustling and you're one in a million, you know, and you're kind of a part of the rat race thing. And it's overwhelming. So then you kind of go back to your studio and you feel this, you know, this sense of like, oh man, like I'm part of this big thing going on. And this is my little version of what's going on. And now the woods, you know, who knows? That's going to be, you know, alone and sparse, you know. So
who knows what it's going to sound like? And do you know? Will you be using different instruments? Do you feel in a different headspace when you go to such a different environment to the ones you've been used to, maybe?
Absolutely. I have 5 acoustic guitars that I'm hoping will kind of make themselves more prevalent.
And at the moment, you're just sitting there. I imagine you're sitting with your feet up, maybe a toothpick in between your teeth.
Yeah, a piece of straw.
Just tuning them up.
Yeah.
A hayseed.
No, I mean, it's cool. Like in the barn, this is the first time since I was a young kid where I lived in my parents' house that I can freely make music in my living space and not worry about a neighbor, you know, hearing me or worry that I'm being too loud for the person down the hall. So in that sense, it's crazy. I can just like, you know, yelp and sing and nobody's going to like say anything.
But do you get, is that a thing about artistic expression or about practicality? Are you ever sort of slightly put off by other people listening to your more outlandish wanderings or the things that maybe don't end up on the record, but your next door neighbor can plainly hear?
Absolutely.
Do you think there's ever been a neighbor with a dictaphone up against the door?
Yeah, well, in New York, I mean, the last place, you didn't need a dictaphone. You know, you could hear everything.
The cops just came around all the time, right?
Oh, luckily, I live next to a musician, so right. I was very lucky in that sense. But, yeah, it's like you're always kind of, you know, looking over your shoulder in a sense, like, oh, I wonder if they can hear me. Because everything's outlandish, you know, at some point. It doesn't become polished until you know, it all fits together. And if I'm listening in the headphones, you know, and I'm singing out loud,
yeah,
he doesn't hear everything else that's going on in the headphones.
No, he's just like, what's on earth?
So I'm sure it sounds very quirky and weird.
To go back to this idea of geography, obviously the Detroit stuff produced records that sounded of a certain type. That was probably the Brooklyn of 30 years ago or 20 years ago, at least, this sparse kind of falling down city. Was that something that attracted you to it, the sort of slightly sort of J.G. Ballard weirdness of this kind of forgotten place?
Detroit is such a remarkable place. Mm. I compare it to Gotham City, yeah. You know, it's a time capsule. There's a great website called ForgottenDetroit.com where people would go and they kind of spelunk in old buildings and just like explore these kind of destroyed, you know, skyscrapers and things.
Yeah.
And one of the photos, a guy went to the old Motown headquarters and his like findings were a filing cabinet with receipts from Marvin Gaye's wife and all the fur coats that she bought.
Oh my God.
You know, and yeah. So that stuff is just there. Like it's sitting in an old building, like water stained, like rust everywhere, asbestos falling down from the ceiling. And that's what Detroit's like. It's just it's like everybody just exploded and left, and these little moments are stuck in time. So, I mean, imagine what that does to
it's
an artist,
amazing,
you know.
Poignancy to it, yeah.
It's so fascinating. And it's sad, too. I mean, I'm not trying to say it's beautiful to see the social, you know, fallout, but it's just such a bizarre place. And
I guess all that Motown had that sound because of the bustling industrial nature of the city and, you know, and the Motown, whatever, that building was, it was professional songwriters working almost like they were making cars, you know?
Yeah.
There was like a production line of songs, wasn't it? And it all had that sound. Is it possible to make something like that, I wonder, in a city where that no longer happens? Do you think it has to be part of that bustling, crazy, industrial kind of production line thing to make music like that?
I think so. I mean, you had so many people wanting it and listening. I mean, that's a totally different era. You know, everywhere was different then, but... well, that's probably why, you know, Detroit Techno came about too, was in response to the absence of everything in the industry and kind of the mechanicalness of the city dying or something, you know.
Sparse. Spooky.
Yes.
I know. Those buildings sort of seem like the kind of place that you could dance around to a lot of that music as much as make it.
It was, you know, for a while when we were going to warehouse events and everything, it was a playground, you know.
Warehouse events, I like that.
Yeah, I guess it's a much more proper way of saying a rave.
Yeah, I was going to say. You're right here. No one's going to bust it. So I like that. Warehouse event. You're cordially invited to a warehouse event. Yes. Did that come in a sort of embossed cardboard invite? Very posh.
Yeah, with a Sharpie. That's what they wrote on it.
Yes, exactly. And I want to also know about your different aliases. You always record different sounds with different aliases. Uh-huh. How does that work? Why'd you do that?
Options, you know. I just needed different options. I had too much to say, you know, when I started doing that, and I didn't want to confuse everybody. So I wanted to put different sounds into different pockets. Mm-hmm. So,
and sort of self-recording and all the rest of it, especially with your move. Will you still be on Ghostly? Are you still working with those guys?
Oh yeah, I mean Ghostly. I've been there since before the label began. I've been friends with Sam, for a year or two before we even started the label. So it's first choice. There's no option. There's no question that I would go anywhere else. And every song that I make, I show Sam first. And it's
so that's
family.
A rare thing, I'd have thought, such a collaborative process with the label.
Yeah, I got really lucky.
Obviously
in that
one
sense.
Which is kind of built on your success and built very much, you know, you two, you and the label have grown up sort of together.
Exactly. Meeting Sam was just a totally remarkable and perfect timing you know, experience in my life. So.
And maybe you can tell us a bit about Beams then.
Yeah.
What were your inspirations for that? I also wonder whether you listen to music while you're recording your own, or whether that's a distraction.
I always listen to music. Yeah. But the palette doesn't change too often. You know, it's been heavily, you know, Can, you know, Brian Eno, Arthur Russell, Gary Newman,
yeah,
some old, like, you know, industrial stuff as well, but it doesn't veer too far off that path. And yeah, the album itself, you know, it reflects that stuff. There's no doubt that the music that I listen to and ingest doesn't get kind of spit out again,
yeah,
through my own interpretation.
And obviously you're here in the UK talking to us now. Well, what happens this summer? You're touring.
Yeah.
And where does the summer take you?
Yeah, so I'm DJing this summer. Few more dates. I'm going to Panorama Bar in Berlin.
Uh-huh.
Should be great. If the weather's good, I'll be playing outside in the garden, which is really, really fun. And after that, I go to DC10 in Ibiza. And then I head home. And I'm going to be kind of on hiatus for about a month or two before I hit the road with the band and start supporting Beams and, you know, promoting it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And you're going to, and how does it, when you're playing, when you're going to be writing a record that sounds like it might sound different, or is certainly being recorded in such a different place as upstate New York as it was in Brooklyn, can you do that while you're kind of on the road? Can you write stuff? I mean, do you write on the road, or do you have to be sort of static?
No, absolutely. I love writing.
Yeah.
It's different. You know, you can't really finish a song, but you can get some good
ideas.
I didn't
mean like that.
It's more techno. You know? Like, I do the dance stuff on the road because it passes the time. If you're sitting in a hotel doing nothing, you might as well just put on the headphones and start working on some loops or something. You know?
I love that. That's the sort of mystery of songwriting revealed there. Passes the time.
Yeah. Well, that's what I do.
I like that. No,
it's like
I like
doodling
that.
To me. You know? It's all I do. It's been since I was 14. You know, I wake up, I turn on some machines, and I tinker with sound. So,
cool. Well, Matthew Dear, thank you so much for telling us about Beams, about the move, about the aliases, and for some reason going off on a tangent about Motown, all in a healthy way. Matthew, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having
me. My heart, it weighs about a ton. In snakes, I feel hollow as a grave I have to dig.
That was Matthew Dear talking to our culture editor, Robert Bound. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Well, we've done a few cultural highlights here. We spoke to Gavin Essler.
Yeah, I like Gavin. Gav.
Yes.
As I like to call him.
What I quite like about him is he's one of those people who gets the best out of people without kind of being provocative or... You know, he's just a good questioner.
Mm. Yes, unlike some of his contemporaries who are Rottweiler-like and don't necessarily always get the juicy bone.
Yes. Well, that's all for this edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Paul Noble and it was researched by Tom Hall. We end with this from Jessie Ware, released this week and taken from her upcoming album, Devotion, that's out tomorrow. This is Wildest Moments. But from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Steve Bloomfield.
It's goodbye.